and you've been reporting faithfully to her, I suppose. Or have you been faithless to the mayor also?
I reported to her. I had no choice, actually. She placed a hyper relay on board ship, which I wasn't supposed to find, but which I did find.
Well?
Unfortunately, it's hooked up so that I can't remove it without immobilizing the vessel. At least, there's no way I can remove it. Consequently, she knows where I am, and she knows where you are.
Suppose you hadn't been able to follow me. Then she wouldn't have known where I was, had you thought of that.
Of course I did. I thought of just reporting I had lost you. But she wouldn't have believed me, would she? And I wouldn't have been able to get back to Terminus for who knows how long. And I'm not like you, Trevise. I'm not a carefree person without attachments. I have a wife on Terminus, a pregnant wife, and I want to get back to her. You can afford to think only of yourself. I can't. Besides, I've come to warn you.
By Selden, I'm trying to do that, and you won't listen. You keep talking about other things.
I'm not impressed by your sudden concern for me. What can you warn me against? It seems to me that you are the only thing I need to be warned about. You betray me, and now you follow me in order to betray me again. No one else is doing me any harm.
Campor said earnestly, "Forget the dramatics, man. Trevise, you're a lightning rod. You've been sent out to draw a second Foundation response, if there is such a thing as a second Foundation. I have an intuitive sense for things other than hyperspatial pursuit, and I'm sure that's what she's planning. If you try to find the second Foundation, they'll become aware of it, and they'll act against you. If they do, they are very likely to tip their hand, and when they do, Mayor Branno will go for them."
"A pity your famous intuition wasn't working when Branno was planning my arrest."
Campor flushed and muttered, "You know it doesn't always work."
"And now it tells you she's planning to attack the second Foundation. She wouldn't dare."
"I think she would. But that's not the point. The point is that right now she is throwing you out as bait."
"So?"
"So, by all the black holes in space, don't search for the second Foundation. She won't care if you're killed in the search, but I care. I feel responsible for this, and I care."
"I'm touched," said Trevise coldly. "But as it happens, I have another task on hand at the moment."
"You have?"
"Pellerat and I are on the track of Earth, the planet that some think was the original home of the human race. Aren't we, Genoff?"
Pellerat nodded his head. "Yes, it's a purely scientific matter and a long-standing interest of mine."
Campor looked blank for a moment, then,
"Looking for Earth? But why?"
"To study it," said Pellerat, "as the one world on which human beings developed, presumably from lower forms of life, instead of, as on all others, merely arriving ready-made. It should be a fascinating study in uniqueness."
"And," said Trevise, "as a world where, just possibly, I may learn more of the Second Foundation. Just possibly."
Campor said,
"But there isn't any Earth. Didn't you know that?"
"No Earth?" Pellerat looked utterly blank, as he always did when he was preparing to be stubborn.
"Are you saying there was no planet on which the human species originated?"
"Oh, no. Of course there was an Earth. There's no question of that. But there isn't any Earth now. No inhabited Earth. It's gone."
Pellerat said, unmoved.
"There are tales." "Hold on, Genoff," said Trevise.
"Tell me, Campor, how do you know this?"
"What do you mean? How? It's my heritage. I trace my ancestry from the Sirius sector, if I may repeat that fact without boring you. We know all about Earth out there. It exists in that sector, which means it's not part of the Foundation Federation, so apparently no one on Terminus bothers with it. But that's where Earth is, just the same."
"That is one suggestion, yes," said Pellerat. "There was considerable enthusiasm for that Sirius alternative, as they called it, in the days of the Empire."
Campor said vehemently,
"It's not an alternative. It's a fact."
Pellerat said, "What would you say if I told you I know of many different places in the galaxy that are called Earth, or were called Earth, by the people who lived in its stellar neighborhood?"
"But this is the real thing," said Campor. "The Sirius sector is the longest inhabited portion of the galaxy. Everyone knows that."
"The Syrians claim it, certainly," said Pellerat, unmoved.
Campor looked frustrated. "I tell you..."
But Trevise said, "Tell us what happened to Earth. You say it's not inhabited any longer. Why not?"
"Radioactivity. The whole planetary surface is radioactive because of nuclear reactions that went out of control, or nuclear explosions, I'm not sure, and now no life is possible there."
The three stared at each other for a while, and then Campor felt it necessary to repeat. He said,
"I tell you, there's no Earth. There's no use looking for it."
44. Genoff Pellerat's face was, for once, not expressionless. It was not that there was passion in it, or any of the more unstable emotions. It was that his eyes had narrowed, and that a kind of fierce intensity had filled every plane of his face. He said, and his voice lacked any trace of its usual tentative quality,
"How did you say you know all this?"
I told you, said Campor. It's my heritage. Don't be silly, young man. You are a councilman. That means you must be born on one of the Federation worlds. Smyrna, I think you said earlier. That's right. Well then, what heritage are you talking about? Are you telling me that you possess Syrian genes that fill you with inborn knowledge of the Syrian myths concerning Earth? Campor looked taken aback. No, of course not. Then what are you talking about? Campor paused and seemed to gather his thoughts. He said quietly, My family has old books of Syrian history. An external heritage, not an internal one. It's not something we talk about outside, especially if one is intent on political advancement. Treviz seems to think I am, but believe me, I mention it only to good friends. There was a trace of bitterness in his voice. Theoretically, all Foundation citizens are alike, but those from the old worlds of the Federation are more alike than those from the newer ones, and those that trace from worlds outside the Federation are least alike of all. But never mind that. Aside from the books, I once visited the old worlds. Treviz, hey there! Treviz had wandered off toward one end of the room, looking out a triangular window. It served to let in a view of the sky and to diminish the view of the city, more light and more privacy. Treviz stretched upward to look down. He returned through the empty room. Interesting window design, he said. You called me, Councilman? Yes. Remember the post-collegiate tour I took? After graduation, I remember very well. We were pals. Pals forever. Foundation of trust. Two against the world. You went off on your tour. I joined the Navy, full of patriotism. Somehow, I didn't think I wanted to tour with you. Some instinct told me not to. I wish the instinct had stayed with me. Campor did not rise to the bait. He said, I visited Camporeon. Family tradition said that my ancestors had come from there, at least on my father's side. We were of the ruling family in ancient times, before the Empire absorbed us, and my name is derived from the world, or so the family tradition has it. We had an old poetic name for the star Camporeon circled, Epsilon Eridani. What does that mean? Asked Pellerat. Campor shook his head. I don't know that it has any meaning, just tradition. They live with a great deal of tradition. It's an old world. They have long, detailed records of Earth's history, but no one talks about it much. They're superstitious about it. Every time they mention the word, they lift up both hands with first and second fingers crossed to ward off misfortune. Did you tell this to anyone when you came back? Of course not. Who would be interested? And I wasn't going to force the tale on anyone. No, thank you. I had a political career to develop, and the last thing I want is to stress my foreign origin. What about the satellite? Describe Earth's satellite, said Pellerat sharply. Campor looked astonished. I don't know anything about that. Does it have one? I don't recall reading or hearing about it, but I'm sure if you consult the Camporeonian records, you can find out. But you know nothing? Not about the satellite, not that I recall. How did Earth come to be radioactive? Campor shook his head and said nothing. Pellerat said, Think, you must have heard something. It was 7 years ago, Professor. I didn't know then you'd be questioning me about it now. There was some sort of legend. They considered it history. What was the legend? Earth was radioactive, ostracized and mistreated by the Empire, its population dwindling, and it was going to destroy the Empire somehow. One dying world was going to destroy the whole Empire, interposed Treviz. Campor said defensively, I said it was a legend. I don't know the details. Del Avardon was involved in the tale, I know. Who was he? Asked Treviz. A historical character. I looked him up. He was an honest-to-galaxy archaeologist back in the early days of the Empire, and he maintained that Earth was in the Sirius sector. I've heard the name, said Pellerat. He's a folk hero on Camporeon. Look, if you want to know these things, go to Camporeon. It's no use hanging around here. Pellerat said, Just how did they say Earth planned to destroy the Empire? Don't know. A certain sullenness was entering Campor's voice. Did the radiation have anything to do with it? Don't know. There were tales of some mind-expander developed on Earth, a synapsifier or something. Did it create superminds? Said Pellerat in deepest tones of incredulity. I don't think so. What I chiefly remember is that it didn't work. People became bright and died young. Treviz said, It was probably a morality myth. If you ask for too much, you lose even that which you have. Pellerat turned on Treviz in annoyance. What do you know of morality myths? Treviz raised his eyebrows. Your field may not be my field, Genoff, but that doesn't mean I'm totally ignorant. What else do you remember about what you call the synapsifier, Councilman Campor? Said Pellerat. Nothing. and I won't submit to any further cross-examination. Look, I followed you on orders from the mayor. I was not ordered to make personal contact with you. I have done so only to warn you that you were followed and tell you that you have been sent out to serve the mayor's purposes, whatever those might be. There was nothing else I should have discussed with you, but you surprised me by suddenly bringing up the matter of Earth. Well, let me repeat. Whatever there has existed there in the past, Bel Arvedan, the Synapsifier, whatever, that has nothing to do with what exists now. I tell you again, Earth is a dead world. I strongly advise you to go to Comporion, where you'll find out everything you want to know. Just get away from here.
And, of course, you will dutifully tell the mayor that we're going to Comporion, and you'll follow us to make sure. Or maybe the mayor knows already. I imagine she has carefully instructed and rehearsed you in every word you have spoken to us here, because for her own purposes, it's in Comporion that she wants us, right? Kampor's face paled. He rose to his feet and almost stuttered in his effort to control his voice.
I've tried to explain. I've tried to be helpful. I shouldn't have tried. You can drop yourself into a black hole, Travis.
He turned on his heel and walked away briskly without looking back. Pellerat seemed a bit stunned.
That was rather tactless of you, Golan, old fellow. I could have gotten more out of him.
No, you couldn't, said Travis gravely. You could not have gotten one thing out of him that he was not ready to let you have. Jennef, you don't know what he is. Until today, I didn't know what he is. 45. Pellerat hesitated to disturb Travis. Travis sat motionless in his chair, deep in thought. Finally, Pellerat said,
Are we just sitting here all night, Golan?
Travis started. No, you're quite right. We'll be better off with people around us. Come. Pellerat rose. He said,
There won't be people around us. Kampor said this was some sort of meditation day.
Is that what he said? Was there traffic when we came along the road in our ground car?
Yes, some.
Quite a bit, I thought. And then, when we entered the city, was it empty?
Not particularly. Still, you've got to admit that this place has been empty.
Yes, it has. I noticed that particularly. But come, Jennef, I'm hungry. There's got to be some place to eat, and we can afford to find something good. At any rate, we can find a place in which we can try some interesting Seychellian novelty, or if we lose our nerve, good standard galactic fare. Come, once we're safely surrounded, I'll tell you what I think really happened here. 46. Travis leaned back with a pleasant feeling of renewal. The restaurant was not expensive by Terminus standards, but it was certainly novel. It was heated in part by an open fire over which food was prepared. Meat tended to be served in bite-sized portions in a variety of pungent sauces, which were picked up by fingers that were protected from grease and heat by smooth green leaves that were cold, damp, and had a vaguely minty taste. It was one leaf to each meat bit, and the whole was taken into the mouth. The waiter had carefully explained how it had to be done. Apparently accustomed to off-planet guests, he had smiled paternally as Travis and Pellerat gingerly scooped at the steaming bits of meat, and was clearly delighted at the foreigner's relief at finding that the leaves kept the fingers cool and cooled the meat, too, as one chewed. Travis said, Delicious, and eventually ordered a second helping. So did Pellerat. They sat over a spongy, vaguely sweet dessert and a cup of coffee that had a caramelized flavor, at which they shook dubious heads. They added syrup, at which the waiter shook his head. Pellerat said,
Well, what happened back there at the tourist center?
You mean with Kampor? Was there anything else there we might discuss? Travis looked about. They were in a deep alcove and had a certain limited privacy, but the restaurant was crowded, and the natural hum of noise was a perfect cover. He said in a low voice, Isn't it strange that he followed us to Seychelles? He said he had this intuitive ability. Yes, he was all-collegiate champion at hyper-tracking. I never questioned that till today. I quite see that you might be able to judge where someone was going to jump by how he prepared for it if you had a certain developed skill at it, certain reflexes. But I don't see how a tracker can judge a jump series. You prepare only for the first one. The computer does all the others. The tracker can judge that first one. But by what magic can he guess what's in the computer's vitals?
But he did it, Golan.
He certainly did, said Travis. And the only possible way I can imagine him doing so is by knowing in advance where we were going to go, by knowing, not judging. Pellerat considered that.
Quite impossible, my boy. How could he know? We didn't decide on our destination till after we were on board the Far Star.
I know that. And what about this day of meditation?
Kampor didn't lie to us. The waiter said it was a day of meditation when we came in here and asked him.
Yes, he did. But he said the restaurant wasn't closed. In fact, what he said was, Seychelles City isn't the backwoods. It doesn't close down.
People meditate, in other words, but not in the big town, where everyone is sophisticated and there's no place for small-town piety. So there's traffic, and it's busy. Well, perhaps not quite as busy as on ordinary days, but busy. But, Colin, no one came into the tourist center while we were there. I was aware of that. Not one person entered. I noticed that, too. I even went to the window at one point and looked out and saw clearly that the streets around the center had a good scattering of people on foot and in vehicles, and yet not one person entered. The day of meditation made a good cover. We would not have questioned the fortunate privacy we had if I simply hadn't made up my mind not to trust that son of two strangers. Ballarat said, "What is the significance of all this, then?" "I think it's simple, Genoff. We have here someone who knows where we're going as soon as we do, even though he and we are in separate spaceships, and we also have here someone who can keep a public building empty when it is surrounded by people, in order that we might talk in convenient privacy." "Would you have me believe he can perform miracles?" "Certainly. If it so happens that Kumpor is an agent of the Second Foundation and can control minds, if he can read yours and mine in a distant spaceship, if he can influence his way through a customs station at once, if he can land gravitically with no border patrol outraged at his defiance of the radio beams, and if he can influence minds in such a way as to keep people from entering a building he doesn't want entered." "By all the stars," Trevise went on with a marked air of grievance, "I can even follow this back to graduation. I didn't go on the tour with him. I remember not wanting to. Wasn't that a matter of his influence? He had to be alone. Where was he really going?" Pellerat pushed away the dishes before him, as though he wanted to clear a space about himself in order to have room to think. It seemed to be a gesture that signaled the busboy robot, a self-moving table that stopped near them and waited while they placed their dishes and cutlery upon it. When they were alone, Pellerat said, "But that's mad. Nothing has happened that could not have happened naturally. Once you get it into your head that somebody is controlling events, you can interpret everything in that light and find no reasonable certainty anywhere. Come on, old fellow, it's all circumstantial and a matter of interpretation. Don't yield to paranoia." "I'm not going to yield to complacency either." "Well, let's look at this logically. Suppose he was an agent of the Second Foundation. Why would he run the risk of rousing our suspicions by keeping the tourist center empty? What did he say that was so important that a few people at a distance, who would have been wrapped in their own concerns anyway, would have made a difference?" "There's an easy answer to that, Genoff. He would have to keep our minds under close observation, and he wanted no interference from other minds, no static, no chance of confusion." "Again, just your interpretation. What was so important about his conversation with us? It would make sense to suppose, as he himself insisted, that he met us only in order to explain what he had done, to apologize for it, and to warn us of the trouble that might await us. Why would we have to look further than that?" The small card receptacle at the farther rim of the table glittered unobtrusively, and the figures representing the cost of the meal flashed briefly. Trevise groped beneath his sash for his credit card, which, with its Foundation imprint, was good anywhere in the galaxy, or anywhere a Foundation citizen was likely to go. He inserted it in the appropriate slot. It took a moment to complete the transaction, and Trevise, with native caution, checked on the remaining balance before returning it to its pocket. He looked about casually to make sure there was no undesirable interest in him on the faces of any of the few who still sat in the restaurant, and then said, "Why look further than that? Why look further?" That was not all he talked about. He talked about Earth. He told us it was dead, and urged us very strongly to go to Kumporion. Shall we go? "It's something I've been considering, Golan," admitted Pellerat. "Just leave here?" "We can come back after we check out the Sirius sector."
"It doesn't occur to you that his whole purpose in seeing us was to deflect us from Seychelles and get us out of here, get us anywhere but here?"
"Why?"
"I don't know. See here, they expected us to go to Trantor. That was what you wanted to do, and maybe that's what they counted on us doing. I messed things up by insisting we go to Seychelles, which is the last thing they wanted, and so now they have to get us out of here."
Pellerat looked distinctly unhappy. "But, Golan, you are just making statements. Why don't they want us on Seychelles?"
"I don't know, Genoff, but it's enough for me that they want us out. I'm staying here. I'm not going to leave."
But, look, Golan, if the Second Foundation wanted us to leave, wouldn't they just influence our minds to make us want to leave? Why bother reasoning with us?"
"Now that you bring up the point, haven't they done that in your case, Professor?" And Trevise's eyes narrowed in sudden suspicion. "Don't you want to leave?"
Pellerat looked at Trevise in surprise. "I just think there's some sense to it."
"Of course you would, if you've been influenced.
But I haven't been.
Of course you would swear you hadn't been if you had been.
Pellerette said, If you box me in this way, there's no way of disproving your bare assertion. What are you going to do?
I will remain in Seychelles, and you'll stay here too. You can't navigate the ship without me, so if Campor has influenced you, he has influenced the wrong one.
Very well, Golan. We'll stay in Seychelles until we have independent reasons to leave. The worst thing we can do, after all, worse than either staying or going, is to fall out with each other. Come, old chap, if I had been influenced, would I be able to change my mind and go along with you cheerfully, as I plan to do now?
Trevise thought for a moment, and then, as though with an inner shake, smiled and held out his hand. Agreed, Janoff. Now, let's get back to the ship and make another start tomorrow, if we can think of one.
47. Munley Campor did not remember when he had been recruited. For one thing, he had been a child at the time. For another, the agents of the Second Foundation were meticulous in removing their traces as far as that was possible. Campor was an observer, and to a Second Foundationer, he was instantly recognizable as such. It meant that Campor was acquainted with mentalics and could converse with Second Foundationers in their own fashion to a degree, but he was in the lowest rank of the hierarchy. He could catch glimpses of minds, but he could not adjust them. The education he had received had never gone that far. He was an observer, not a doer. It made him second class at best, but he did not mind much. He knew his importance in the scheme of things. During the early centuries of the Second Foundation, it had underestimated the task before it. It had imagined that its handful of members could monitor the entire galaxy, and that Selden's plan to be maintained would require only the most occasional, the lightest touch here and there. The mule had stripped them of these delusions. Coming from nowhere, he had caught the Second Foundation, and of course the First, though that didn't matter, utterly by surprise, and had left them helpless. It took 5 years before a counterattack could be organized, and then only at the cost of a number of lives. With Palver, a full recovery was made, again at a distressing cost, and he finally took the appropriate measures. The operations of the Second Foundation, he decided, must be enormously expanded, without at the same time increasing the chances of detection unduly, so he instituted the Corps of Observers. Campor did not know how many observers were in the galaxy, or even how many there were on Terminus. It was not his business to know. Ideally, there should be no detectable connection between any two observers, so that the loss of one would not entail the loss of any other. All connections were with the upper echelons on Trantor. It was Campor's ambition to go to Trantor someday. Though he thought it extremely unlikely, he knew that occasionally an observer might be brought to Trantor and promoted, but that was rare. The qualities that made for a good observer were not those that pointed toward the table. There was Gendebal, for instance, who was 4 years younger than Campor. He must have been recruited as a boy, just as Campor was, but he had been taken directly to Trantor and was now a speaker. Campor had no illusions as to why that should be. He had been much in contact with Gendebal of late, and he had experienced the power of that young man's mind. He could not have stood up against it for a second. Campor was not often conscious of a lowly status. There was almost never occasion to consider it. After all, as in the case of other observers, he imagined, it was only lowly by the standards of Trantor. On their own non-Trantorian worlds, in their own non-mentalic societies, it was easy for observers to obtain high status. Campor, for instance, had never had trouble getting into good schools or finding good company. He had been able to use his mentalics in a simple way to enhance his natural intuitive ability. That natural ability had been why he had been recruited in the first place, he was sure. And in this way, to prove himself a star at hyperspatial pursuit. He became a hero at college, and this set his foot on the first rung of a political career. Once this present crisis was over, there was no telling how much farther he might advance. If the crisis resolved itself successfully, as surely it would it not be recalled that it was Campor who had first noted Trevise, not as a human being, anyone could have done that, but as a mind? He had encountered Trevise in college, and had seen him at first only as a jovial and quick-witted companion. One morning, however, he had stirred sluggishly out of slumber, and in the stream of consciousness that accompanied the never-never land of half-sleep, he felt what a pity it was that Trevise had never been recruited. Trevise couldn't have been recruited, of course, since he was Terminus-born, and not, like Campor, a native of another world. And even with that aside, it was too late. Only the quite young are plastic enough to receive an education into mentalics. The painful introduction of that art, it was more than a science, into adult brains set rustily in their mold, was a thing of the first two generations after Selden only.
But then, if Trevise had been ineligible for recruiting in the first place, and had outlived the possibility in the second, what had roused Campor's concern over the matter? On their next meeting, Campor had penetrated Trevise's mind deeply, and discovered what it was that must have initially disturbed him. Trevise's mind had characteristics that did not fit the rules he had been taught. Over and over it eluded him. As he followed its workings, he found gaps. No, they couldn't be actual gaps, actual leaps of non-existence. They were places where Trevise's manner of mind dove too deeply to be followed. Campor had no way of determining what this meant, but he watched Trevise's behavior in the light of what he had discovered, and he began to suspect that Trevise had an uncanny ability to reach right conclusions from what would seem to be insufficient data. Did this have something to do with the gaps? Surely this was a matter for mentalism beyond his own powers, for the table itself, perhaps. He had the uneasy feeling that Trevise's powers of decision were unknown in their full to the man himself, and that he might be able to... To do what? Campor's knowledge did not suffice. He could almost see the meaning of what Trevise possessed, but not quite. There was only the intuitive conclusion, or perhaps just a guess, that Trevise might be potentially a person of the utmost importance. He had to take the chance that this might be so, and to risk seeming to be less than qualified for his post. After all, if he were correct, he was not sure, looking back on it, how he had managed to find the courage to continue his efforts. He could not penetrate the administrative barriers that ringed the table. He had all but reconciled himself to a broken reputation. He had worked himself down, despairingly, to the most junior member of the table. And finally, Stora Gendebald had responded to his call. Gendebald had listened patiently, and from that time on there had been a special relationship between them. It was on Gendebald's behalf that Campor had maintained his relationship with Trevise, and on Gendebald's direction that he had carefully set up the situation that had resulted in Trevise's exile. And it was through Gendebald that Campor might yet, he was beginning to hope, achieve his dream of promotion to Trantor. All preparations, however, had been designed to send Trevise to Trantor. Trevise's refusal to do this had taken Campor entirely by surprise, and, Campor thought, had been unforeseen by Gendebald as well. At any rate, Gendebald was hurrying to the spot, and to Campor, that deepened the sense of crisis. Campor sent out his hypersignal. 48. Gendebald was roused from his sleep by the touch on his mind. It was effective and not in the least disturbing. Since it affected the arousal center directly, he simply awoke. He sat up in bed, the sheet falling from his well-shaped and smoothly muscular torso. He had recognized the touch. The differences were as distinctive to mentalists as were voices to those who communicated primarily by sound. Gendebald sent out the standard signal, asking if a small delay were possible, and the no-emergency call returned. Without undue haste, then, Gendebald attended to the morning routine. He was still in the ship's shower, with the used water draining into the recycling mechanisms when he made contact again. Campor?
Yes, Speaker.
Have you spoken with Trevise and the other one?
Pellerat. Yanov Pellerat. Yes, Speaker.
Good. Give me another 5 minutes and I'll arrange visuals. He passed Suranovi on his way to the controls. She looked at him questioningly and made as though to speak, but he placed a finger on his lips and she subsided at once. Gendebald still felt a bit uncomfortable at the intensity of adoration respect in her mind, but it was coming to be a comfortingly normal part of his environment somehow. He had hooked a small tendril of his mind to hers, and there would now be no way to affect his mind without affecting hers. The simplicity of her mind, and there was an enormous aesthetic pleasure to be found in contemplating its unadorned symmetry, Gendebald couldn't help thinking, made it impossible for any extraneous minefield to exist in their neighborhood without detection. He felt a surge of gratitude for the courteous impulse that had moved him that moment they had stood together outside the university, and that had led her to come to him precisely when she could be most useful. He said,
Campor?
Yes, Speaker?
Relax, please. I must study your mind. No offense is intended.
As you wish, Speaker. May I ask the purpose?
To make certain you are untouched.
Campor said, I know you have political adversaries at the table, Speaker, but surely none of them...
Do not speculate, Campor. Relax. Yes, you are untouched. Now, if you will cooperate with me, we will establish visual contact.
What followed was, in the ordinary sense of the word, an illusion, since no one but someone who was aided by the mentalic power of a well-trained second foundationer would have been able to detect anything at all,
either by the senses or by any physical detecting device. It was the building up of a face and its appearance from the contours of a mind, and even the best mentalist could succeed in producing only a shadowy and somewhat uncertain figure. Kampor's face was there in mid-space, as though it were seen through a thin but shifting curtain of gauze, and Jindabal knew that his own face appeared in an identical manner in front of Kampor. By physical hyperwave, communication could have been established through images so clear that speakers who were 1,000 parsecs apart might judge themselves to be face-to-face. Jindabal's ship was equipped for the purpose. There were, however, advantages to the mentalist vision. The chief was that it could not be tapped by any device known to the First Foundation. Nor, for that matter, could one Second Foundationer tap the mentalist vision of another. The play of mind might be followed, but not the delicate change of facial expression that gave the communication its finer points. As for the anti-mules, well, the purity of Novi's mind was sufficient to assure him that none were about. He said, "Tell me precisely, Kampor, the talk you had with Trevise and with this Pellerat, precisely to the level of mind."
"Of course, Speaker," said Kampor.
It didn't take long. The combination of sound, expression, and mentalism compressed matters considerably, despite the fact that there was far more to tell at the level of mind than if there had been a mere parroting of speech. Jindabal watched intently. There was little redundancy, if any, in mentalist vision. In true vision, or even in physical hypervision across the parsecs, one saw enormously more in the way of information bits than was absolutely necessary for comprehension, and one could miss a great deal without losing anything significant. Through the gauze of mentalist vision, however, one bought absolute security at the price of losing the luxury of being able to miss bits. Every bit was significant. There were always horror tales that passed from instructor to student on Trantor, tales that were designed to impress on the young the importance of concentration. The most often repeated was certainly the least reliable. It told of the first report on the progress of the mule before he had taken over Kalgan, of the minor official who received the report and who had no more than the impression of a horse-like animal because he did not see or understand the small flick that signified personal name. The official therefore decided that the whole thing was too unimportant to pass on to Trantor. By the time the next message came, it was too late to take immediate action, and 5 more bitter years had to pass. The event had almost certainly never happened, but that didn't matter. It was a dramatic story, and it served to motivate every student into the habit of intent concentration. Jindabal remembered his own student days when he made an error in reception that seemed in his own mind to be both insignificant and understandable. His teacher, old Kendast, a tyrant to the roots of his cerebellum, had simply sneered and said, "A horse-like animal, Cub Jindabal?" And that had been enough to make him collapse in shame. Kampor finished. Jindabal said, "Your estimate, please, of Trevise's reaction. You know him better than I do, better than anyone does." Kampor said,
"It was clear enough. The mentalic indications were unmistakable. He thinks my words and actions represent my extreme anxiety to have him go to Trantor, or to the Sirius sector, or to any place but where, in fact, he is actually going. It meant, in my opinion, that he would remain firmly where he was. The fact that I attached great importance to his shifting his position, in short, forced him to give it the same importance, and since he feels his own interest to be diametrically opposed to mine, he will deliberately act against what he interprets to be my wish."
"You are certain of that?"
"Quite certain."
Jindabal considered this and decided that Kampor was correct. He said, "I am satisfied. You have done well. Your tale of Earth's radioactive destruction was cleverly chosen to help produce the proper reaction without the need for direct manipulation of the mind. Commendable." Kampor seemed to struggle with himself a short moment.
"Speaker," he said, "I cannot accept your praise. I did not invent the tale. It is true. There really is a planet called Earth in the Sirius sector, and it really is considered to be the original home of humanity. It was radioactive, either to begin with or eventually, and this grew worse till the planet died. There was indeed a mind-enhancing invention that came to nothing. All this is considered history on the home planet of my ancestors."
"So? Interesting," said Jindabal with no obvious conviction. "And better yet, to know when a truth will do is admirable, since no non-truth can be presented with the same sincerity. Palver once said, 'The closer to the truth, the better the lie, and the truth itself, when it can be used, is the best lie.'"
Kampor said, "There is one thing more to say. In following instructions to keep Trevise in the Seychelles sector until you arrived, and to do so at all costs, I had to go so far in my efforts that it is clear that he suspects me of being under the influence of the Second Foundation.
Gendebal nodded. That, I think, is unavoidable under the circumstances. His monomania on the subject would be sufficient to have him see Second Foundation, even where it was not. We must simply take that into account.
Speaker, if it is absolutely necessary that Trevise stay where he is until you can reach him, it would simplify matters if I came to meet you, took you aboard my ship, and brought you back. It would take less than a day.
No, Observer, said Gendebal sharply. You will not do this. The people on Terminus know where you are. You have a hyper-relay on your ship which you cannot remove, have you not?
Yes, Speaker.
And if Terminus knows you have landed on Seychelles, their ambassador on Seychelles knows of it, and the ambassador knows also that Trevise has landed. Your hyper-relay will tell Terminus that you have left for a specific point hundreds of parsecs away and returned, and the ambassador will inform them that Trevise has, however, remained in the sector. From this, how much will the people at Terminus guess? The mayor of Terminus is, by all accounts, a shrewd woman, and the last thing we want to do is to alarm her by presenting her with an obscure puzzle. We don't want her to lead a section of her fleet here. The chances of that are, in any case, uncomfortably high.
Kampor said, With respect, Speaker, what reason do we have to fear a fleet if we can control a commander?
However little reason there might be, there is still less reason to fear if the fleet is not here. You stay where you are, Observer. When I reach you, I will join you on your ship. And then?
And then, Speaker?
Why, and then I will take over.
49. Gendebal sat in place after he dismantled the Ventalist vision and stayed there for long minutes, considering. During this long trip to Seychelles, unavoidably long in this ship of his, which could in no way match the technological advancement of the products of the First Foundation, he had gone over every single report on Trevise. The reports had stretched over nearly a decade. Seen as a whole, and in the light of recent events, there was no longer any doubt Trevise would have been a marvelous recruit for the Second Foundation, if the policy of never touching the Terminus-born had not been in place since Palver's time. There was no telling how many recruits of highest quality had been lost to the Second Foundation over the centuries. There was no way of evaluating every one of the quadrillions of human beings populating the galaxy. None of them was likely to have had more promise than Trevise, however, and certainly none could have been in a more sensitive spot. Gendebal shook his head slightly. Trevise should never have been overlooked, Terminus-born or not, and credit to Observer Kampor for seeing it, even after the years it distorted him. Trevise was of no use to them now. Of course, he was too old for the molding, but he still had that inborn intuition, that ability to guess a solution on the basis of totally inadequate information, and something... Old Chandis, who, despite being past his prime, was first speaker and had, on the whole, been a good one, saw something there, even without the correlated data and the reasoning that Gendebal had worked out in the course of this trip. Trevise, Chandis had thought, was the key to the crisis. Why was Trevise here at Seychelles? What was he planning? What was he doing? And he couldn't be touched. Of that Gendebal was sure. Until it was known precisely what Trevise's role was, it would be totally wrong to try to modify him in any way. With the anti-mules, whoever they were, whatever they might be in the field, a wrong move with respect to Trevise, Trevise above all, might explode a wholly unexpected microsun in their faces. He felt a mind hovering about his own, and absently brushed at it, as he might at one of the more annoying Trantorian insects, though with mind rather than hand. He felt the instant wash of other pain, and looked up. Soranovi had her palm to her furrowed brow.
Your pardon, master, I be struck with sudden head anguish.
Gendebal was instantly contrite. I'm sorry, Novi, I wasn't thinking, or I was thinking too intently. Instantly and gently, he smoothed the ruffled mind tendrils.
Novi smiled with sudden brightness.
It passed with sudden vanishing. That kind sound of your words, master, works well upon me.
Gendebal said, Good. Is something wrong? Why are you here? He forbore to enter her mind in greater detail in order to find out for himself. More and more, he felt a reluctance to invade her privacy. Novi hesitated. She leaned toward him slightly.
I be concerned. You are looking at nothing and making sounds, and your face was twitching. I stayed there, stick frozen, afeard you were declining, ill, and unknowing what to do.
It was nothing, Novi. You are not to fear. He patted her nearer hand. There is nothing to fear. Do you understand?
Fear, or any strong emotion, twisted and spoiled the symmetry of her mind somewhat. He preferred it calm and peaceful and happy, but he hesitated at the thought of adjusting it into that position by outer influence. She had felt the previous adjustment to be the effect of his words, and it seemed to him that he preferred it that way. He said,
Novi, why don't I call you Sura?
She looked up at him in sudden woe.
Oh, master, do not do so.
But Rufiran did so on that day that we met. I know you well enough now.
I know well he did so, master. It be how a man speak to a girl who have no man, no betrothed, who is not complete. You say her previous. It is more honorable for me if you say Novi, and I be proud that you say so. And if I have not man now, I have master, and I be pleased. I hope it be not offensive to you to say Novi.
It certainly isn't Novi. And her mind was beautifully smooth at that, and Gendibal was pleased. Too pleased. Ought he to be so pleased? A little shamefacedly, he remembered that the mule was supposed to have been affected in this manner by that woman of the first foundation, Beta Darrell, to his own undoing. This, of course, was different. This Hamish woman was his defense against alien minds, and he wanted her to serve that purpose most efficiently. No, that was not true. His function as a speaker would be compromised if he ceased to understand his own mind, or worse, if he deliberately misconstrued it to avoid the truth. The truth was that it pleased him when she was calm and peaceful and happy endogenously, without his interference, and that it pleased him simply because she pleased him, and, he thought defiantly, there was nothing wrong with that. He said, "Sit down, Novi." She did so, balancing herself precariously at the edge of the chair and sitting as far away as the confines of the room allowed. Her mind was flooded with respect. He said, "When you saw me making sounds, Novi, I was speaking at a long distance, scholar fashion." Novi said sadly, her eyes cast down,
"I see, master, that there be much to scholar fashion I understand not and imagine not. It be difficult mountain high art. I be ashamed to have come to you to be made scholar. How is it, master, you did not belaugh me?"
Gendibal said, "It is no shame to aspire to something, even if it is beyond your reach. You are now too old to be made a scholar after my fashion, but you are never too old to learn more than you already know, and to become able to do more than you already can. I will teach you something about this ship. By the time we reach our destination, you will know quite a bit about it." He felt delighted. Why not? He was deliberately turning his back on the stereotype of the Hamish people. What right, in any case, had the heterogeneous group of the Second Foundation to set up such a stereotype? The young produced by them were only occasionally suited to become high-level Second Foundationers themselves. The children of speakers almost never qualified to be speakers. There were the three generations of Lingusters 3 centuries ago, but there was always the suspicion that the middle speaker of that series did not really belong. And, if that were true, who were the people of the university to place themselves on so high a pedestal? He watched Novi's eyes glisten, and was pleased that they did. She said,
"I try hard to learn all you teach me, master."
"I'm sure you will," he said, and then hesitated. It occurred to him that in his conversation with Kampor, he had in no way indicated at any time that he was not alone. There was no hint of a companion. A woman could be taken for granted, perhaps. At least Kampor would no doubt not be surprised. But a Hamish woman? For a moment, despite anything Gendibal could do, the stereotype reigned supreme, and he found himself glad that Kampor had never been on Trantor and would not recognize Novi as a Hamish woman. He shook it off. It didn't matter if Kampor knew or knew not, or if anyone did. Gendibal was a speaker of the Second Foundation, and he could do as he pleased within the constraints of the Zeldin Plan, and no one could interfere. Novi said,
"Master, once we reach our destination, will we part?"
He looked at her and said, with perhaps more force than he intended, "We will not be separated, Novi." And the Hamish woman smiled shyly and looked for all the galaxy as though she might have been any woman. Chapter 13. University. 50. Pellerat wrinkled his nose when he and Treviz re-entered the far star. Treviz shrugged. "The human body is a powerful dispenser of odors. Recycling never works instantaneously, and artificial scents merely overlay. They do not replace.
And I suppose no two ships smell quite alike once they've been occupied for a period of time by different people."
"That's right. But did you smell Seychelles Planet after the first hour?"
"No,"
admitted Pellerat. "Well, you won't smell this after a while either. In fact, if you live in the ship long enough, you'll welcome the odor that greets you on your return as signifying home. And by the way, if you become a galactic rover after this, Genoff, you'll have to learn that it is impolite to comment on the odor of any ship, or for that matter, any world, to those who live on that ship or world. Between us, of course, it's all right."
"As a matter of fact, Golan, the funny thing is I do consider the Far Star home, at least its foundation made."
Pellerat smiled.
"You know, I never considered myself a patriot. I like to think I recognize only humanity as my nation, but I must say that being away from the Foundation fills my heart with love for it."
Treviz was making his bed. "You're not very far from the Foundation, you know. The Seychelles Union is almost surrounded by Federation territory. We have an ambassador and an enormous presence here, from consuls on down. The Seychellians like to oppose us in words, but they are usually very cautious about doing anything that gives us displeasure. Genoff, do turn in. We got nowhere today, and we have to do better tomorrow. Still, there was no difficulty in hearing between the two rooms, however, and when the ship was dark, Pellerat, tossing restlessly, finally said in a not very loud voice,
Golan?
Yes?
You're not sleeping?
Not while you're talking.
We did get somewhere today. Your friend Kampor...
Ex-friend, growled Trevise.
Whatever his status, he talked about Earth and told us something I hadn't come across in my researches before. Radioactivity.
Trevise lifted himself to one elbow. Look, Golan, if Earth is really dead, that doesn't mean we return home. I still want to find Gaia. Pellerat made a puffing noise with his mouth as though he were blowing away feathers.
My dear chap, of course, so do I. Nor do I think Earth is dead. Kampor may have been telling what he felt was the truth, but there's scarcely a sector in the galaxy that doesn't have some tale or other that would place the origin of humanity on some local world, and they almost invariably call it Earth or some closely equivalent name. We call it globocentrism in anthropology. People have a tendency to take it for granted that they are better than their neighbors, that their culture is older and superior to that of other worlds, that what is good in other worlds has been borrowed from them, while what is bad is distorted or perverted in the borrowing or invented elsewhere. And the tendency is to equate superiority in quality with superiority in duration. If they cannot reasonably maintain their own planet to be Earth or its equivalent, and the beginnings of the human species, they almost always do the best they can by placing Earth in their own sector, even when they cannot locate it exactly. Trevise said, And you're telling me that Kampor was just following the common habit when he said Earth existed in the Sirius sector? Still, the Sirius sector does have a long history, so every world in it should be well known, and it should be easy to check the matter even without going there. Pellerat chuckled. Even if you were to show that no world in the Sirius sector could possibly be Earth, that wouldn't help. You underestimate the depths to which mysticism can bury rationality, Golan. There are at least half a dozen sectors in the galaxy where respectable scholars repeat, with every appearance of solemnity and with no trace of a smile, local tales that Earth, or whatever they choose to call it, is located in hyperspace and cannot be reached except by accident.
And do they say anyone has ever reached it by accident?
There are always tales, and there was always a patriotic refusal to disbelieve, even though the tales are never in the least credible, and are never believed by anyone not of the world that produces them.
Then, Genoff, let's not believe them ourselves. Let's enter our own private hyperspace of sleep.
But, Golan, it's this business of Earth's radioactivity that interests me. To me, that seems to bear the mark of truth, or a kind of truth.
What do you mean, a kind of truth?
Well, a world that is radioactive would be a world in which hard radiation would be present in higher concentration than is usual. The rate of mutation would be higher on such a world, and evolution would proceed more quickly and more diversely. I told you, if you remember, that among the points on which almost all the tales agree is that life on Earth was incredibly diverse, millions of species and all kinds of life. It is this diversity of life, this explosive development, that might have brought intelligence to the Earth, and then the surge outward into the galaxy. If Earth were for some reason radioactive, that is, more radioactive than other planets, that might account for everything else about Earth that is, or was, unique.
Trevise was silent for a moment. Then, in the first place, we have no reason to believe Kampor was telling the truth. He may well have been lying freely in order to induce us to leave this place and go chasing madly off to Sirius. I believe that's exactly what he was doing. And even if he were telling the truth, what he said was that there was so much radioactivity that life became impossible. Pellerat made the blowing gesture again.
There wasn't too much radioactivity to allow life to develop on Earth, and it is easier for life to maintain itself once established than to develop in the first place. Granted, then, that life was established and maintained on Earth. Therefore, the level of radioactivity could not have been incompatible with life to begin with, and it can only have fallen off with time. There is nothing that can raise the level.
Nuclear explosions, suggested Trevise.
What would that have to do with it? I mean, suppose nuclear explosions took place on Earth. On Earth's surface? Impossible. There's no record in the history of the galaxy of any society being so foolish as to use nuclear explosions as a weapon of war,
we would never have survived.
During the Trigellian insurrections, when both sides were reduced to starvation and desperation, and when Gendiparis Korat suggested the initiation of a fusion reaction in...
He was hanged by the sailors of his own fleet. I know galactic history. I was thinking of accident.
There's no record of accidents of that sort that are capable of significantly raising the intensity of radioactivity of a planet, generally.
He sighed. I suppose that when we get around to it, we'll have to go to the Sirius sector and do a little prospecting there.
Someday, perhaps, we will. But for now...
Yes, yes. I'll stop talking.
He did. And Trevise lay in the dark for nearly an hour, considering whether he had attracted too much attention already, and whether it might not be wise to go to the Sirius sector and then return to Gaia when attention, everyone's attention, was elsewhere. He had arrived at no clear decision by the time he fell asleep. His dreams were troubled. 51. They did not arrive back in the city till mid-morning. The tourist center was quite crowded this time, but they managed to obtain the necessary directions to a reference library, where in turn they received instruction in the use of the local models of data-gathering computers. They went carefully through the museums and universities, beginning with those that were nearest, and checked out whatever information was available on anthropologists, archaeologists, and ancient historians. Pellaret said,
"Ah!"
"Ah," said Trevise with some asperity.
"Ah, what?"
"This name Quintessets. It seems familiar."
"You know him?"
"No, of course not. But I may have read papers of his back at the ship where I have my reference collection."
"We're not going back, Genoff. If the name is familiar, that's a starting point. If he can't help us, he will undoubtedly be able to direct us further."
He rose to his feet. "Let's find a way of getting to Seychelles University. And since there will be nobody there at lunchtime, let's eat first."
It was not until late afternoon that they had made their way out to the university, worked their way through its maze, and found themselves in an anteroom waiting for a young woman who had gone off in search of information, and who might, or might not, lead them to Quintessets.
"I wonder," said Pellaret uneasily, "how much longer we'll have to wait. It must be getting toward the close of the school day."
And, as though that were a cue, the young lady whom they had last seen half an hour before walked rapidly toward them, her shoes glinting red and violet, and striking the ground with a sharp musical tone as she walked. The pitch varied with the speed and force of her steps. Pellaret winced. He supposed that each world had its own ways of assaulting the senses, just as each had its own smell. He wondered if, now that he no longer noticed the smell, he might also learn not to notice the cacophony of fashionable young women when they walked.
She came to Pellaret and stopped.
"May I have your full name, Professor?"
"It's Genoff Pellaret, miss."
"Your home planet?"
Trevise began to lift one hand as though to enjoin silence, but Pellaret, either not seeing or not regarding, said, "Terminus." The young woman smiled broadly and looked pleased.
"When I told Professor Quintessets that a Professor Pellaret was inquiring for him, he said he would see you if you were Genoff Pellaret of Terminus, but not otherwise."
Pellaret blinked rapidly. You mean he's heard of me?"
"It certainly seems so."
And almost creakily, Pellaret managed to smile as he turned to Trevise.
"He's heard of me. I honestly didn't think... I've written very few papers, and I didn't think that anyone..." He shook his head. "They weren't really important."
"Well, then," said Trevise, smiling himself, "stop hugging yourself in an ecstasy of self-underestimation, and let's go." He turned to the woman. "I presume, miss, there's some sort of transportation to take us to him?"
"It's within walking distance. You won't even have to leave the building complex, and I'll be glad to take you there. Are both of you from Terminus?"
And off she went. The two men followed, and Trevise said with a trace of annoyance, "Yes, we are. Does that make a difference?"
"Oh, no, of course not. There are people on Seychelles that don't like foundationers, you know, but here at the university we're more cosmopolitan than that. Live and let live is what I always say. I mean, foundationers are people, too. You know what I mean?"
"Yes, I know what you mean. Lots of us say that Seychellians are people."
"That's just the way it should be. I've never seen Terminus. It must be a big city."
"Actually, it isn't," said Trevise, matter-of-factly. "I suspect it's smaller than Seychelles City."
"You're tweaking my finger," she said. "It's the capital of the Foundation Federation, isn't it? I mean, there isn't another Terminus, is there?"
"No, there's only one Terminus, as far as I know, and that's where we're from, the capital of the Foundation Federation."
"Well, then, it must be an enormous city, and you're coming all the way here to see the professor? We're very proud of him, you know. He's considered the biggest authority in the whole galaxy."
"Really?" said Trevise. "On what?"
Her eyes opened wide again.
"You are a teaser. He knows more about ancient history than I know about my own family."
and she continued to walk on ahead on her musical feet. One can only be called a teaser and a finger tweaker so often without developing an actual impulse in that direction. Trevise smiled and said, "The professor knows all about Earth, I suppose."
"Earth?"
She stopped at an office door and looked at them blankly. "You know, the world where humanity got its start."
"Oh, you mean the planet that was first? I guess so. I guess he should know all about it. After all, it's located in the Seychelles sector. Everyone knows that. This is his office. Let me signal him."
"Oh, no, don't," said Trevise, "not for just a minute. Tell me about Earth."
"Actually, I never heard anyone call it Earth. I suppose that's a Foundation word. We call it Gaia here."
Trevise cast a swift look at Pellaret. "Oh, and where is it located?"
"Nowhere. It's in hyperspace, and there's no way anyone can get to it. When I was a little girl, my grandmother said that Gaia was once in real space, but it was so disgusted at the
crimes and stupidities of human beings," muttered Pellaret,
"that out of shame it left space and refused to have anything more to do with the human beings it had sent out into the galaxy." "You know the story, then. See? A girlfriend of mine says it's superstition. Well, I'll tell her, if it's good enough for professors from the Foundation."
A glittering section of lettering on the smoky glass of the door read, "Sotane Quintessets Ept," in the hard-to-read Seychellian calligraphy, and under it was printed in the same fashion, "Department of Ancient History." The woman placed her finger on a smooth metal circle. There was no sound, but the smokiness of the glass turned a milky white for a moment, and a soft voice said in an abstracted way, "Identify yourself, please."
"Janoff Pellaret of Terminus," said Pellaret, "with Golan Trevise of the same world."
The door swung open at once. 52. The man who stood up, walked around his desk, and advanced to meet them was tall and well into middle age. He was light brown in skin color, and his hair, which was set in crisp curls over his head, was iron gray. He held out his hand in greeting, and his voice was soft and low. "I am S.Q. I am delighted to meet you, professors." Trevise said, "I don't own an academic title. I merely accompany Professor Pellaret. You may call me simply Trevise. I am pleased to meet you, Professor Abt." Quintessets held up one hand in clear embarrassment. "No, no. Abt is merely a foolish title of some sort that has no significance outside of Seychelles. Ignore it, please, and call me S.Q. We tend to use initials in ordinary social intercourse on Seychelles. I'm so pleased to meet two of you when I had been expecting but one."
He seemed to hesitate a moment, then extended his right hand, after wiping it unobtrusively on his trousers. Trevise took it, wondering what the proper Seychellian manner of greeting was. Quintessets said, "Please sit down. I'm afraid you'll find these chairs to be lifeless ones, but I, for one, don't want my chairs to hug me. It's all the fashion for chairs to hug you nowadays, but I prefer a hug to mean something, eh?"
Quintessets said, "Please sit down. I'm afraid you'll find these chairs to be lifeless ones, but I, for one, don't want my chairs to hug me. It's all the fashion for chairs to hug you nowadays, but I prefer a hug to mean something, eh?"
Trevise smiled and said, "Who would not? Your name, S.Q., seems to be of the Rim Worlds and not Seychellian. I apologize if the remark is impertinent."
"I don't mind. My family traces back in part to Ascone. 5 generations back, my great-great-grandparents left Ascone when Foundation domination grew too heavy."
Pellaret said, "And we are Foundationers. Our apologies." Quintessets waved his hand genially.
"I don't hold a grudge across a stretch of 5 generations. Not that such things haven't been done, more's the pity. Would you like to have something to eat, to drink? Would you like music in the background?"
"If you don't mind," said Pellaret, "I'd be willing to get right to business if Seychellian ways would permit."
"Seychellian ways are not a barrier to that, I assure you. You have no idea how remarkable this is, Dr. Pellaret. It was only about 2 weeks ago that I came across your article on origin myths in the Archaeological Review, and it struck me as a remarkable synthesis, all too brief."
Pellaret flushed with pleasure.
"How delighted I am that you have read it. I had to condense it, of course, since the review would not print a full study. I have been planning to do a treatise on the subject."
"I wish you would.
In any case, as soon as I had read it, I had this desire to see you. I even had the notion of visiting Terminus in order to do so, though that would have been hard to arrange."
"Why so?" asked Trevise. Quintessets looked embarrassed.
"I'm sorry to say that Seychelles is not eager to join the Foundation Federation, and rather discourages any social communication with the Foundation. We've a tradition of neutralism, you see.
Even the mule didn't bother us, except to extort from us a specific statement of neutrality. For that reason, any application for permission to visit Foundation territory generally, and particularly Terminus, is viewed with suspicion, although a scholar such as myself, intent on academic business, would probably obtain his passport in the end.